Welcome to the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast. If your job involves working with or influencing people's behavior, this podcast offers invaluable insights into what makes people tick. Through personal interviews that are thoughtful and surprising, we explore the full range of the roots to people smarts that can help you make or break your own career. My name is Marie Gervais, and with a PhD in culture and learning in the workplace and my own cultural journey, I bring the mysteries of human beings at work around the world to you. Through conversations with very diverse people, examining the groups they were born into and the ones they chose to belong to, my podcast takes a deep dive into why people do what they do and how they belong. Hone your skills to manage others and to be a better human being at work with the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast. And now for today's episode. Hello, Culture and Leadership Connections podcast listeners. Today, I'm very excited to present to you a most wonderful guest. His name is Dr. Alan Akira. He is a board-certified psychiatrist and the founder of Mugen Psychiatry, serving patients in the Chicago, Illinois area. His mission is to improve psychiatric care access, utilizing his skills in clinical decision-making, education, entrepreneurship, and healthcare management. So a multi-talented doctor of psychiatry. He has studied in many different interesting places, but his clinical excellence is what stands out for me because he has earned awards, including the Rush Emergency Medicine Consultant of the Year and Resident Physician of the Year from the Illinois Psychiatric Society. He's also the recipient of the Asclepius Award and the prestigious Roski Award for Teaching from the APA, which is the American Psychiatry Association. Additionally, he serves as an independent medical examiner for Cook County, providing expert psychiatric opinions. Welcome, Dr. Akira.
Thank you so much to you and your audience for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. And I have interviewed one other psychiatrist who is the first Indigenous female psychiatrist in Canada. And it was a wonderful interview. And so I'm really looking forward to yours.
Oh, man, that's a high place to try to compare myself to. I'm happy to be here.
No comparisons required. It's all excellence. So please tell the audience a little bit about who you are and what you do in your personal life, because we already have the professional bio. So, you know, you must have been born somewhere. You must have come from a family. Tell us a little bit about you.
Sure. So I was initially born in Brooklyn, New York, in a small Sicilian Italian-American neighborhood called Bensonhurst until I was about 12 or 13 years old. I'm half Korean and half Chinese, and my family, just a bunch of blue-collared workers. You know, my father was an automotive mechanic. My mother worked in finance at a car dealership. My grandparents immigrated here from Korea on my mom's side. They opened a small fish market back in the 70s. I am the first person to thankfully get through college by the grace of a higher power, get through medical school, and now I'm a practicing psychiatrist here in Chicago, Illinois, where I work with a team of multi-talented people. And I'm happy to say that we are providing clinical care in the hospital settings in and around Chicago.
That's wonderful. Do you think there's an increasing need, or is it just that people are now noticing and accepting more issues of mental illness?
I think the need has always been high, but folks have not come forward as often as they are now. I think mental health is one of those things that it's a priority and ever present in many of our minds, but the action needed to be taken to actually address it has been greatly minimized, likely secondary to the cultural and societal expectations here in the US, where we are a very work, work, work culture. And I think only now we're only at the tip of the iceberg where we're noticing folks are getting burnt out, and the needs and the wants of trying to address our mental health. Now it's more of a requirement to do so because we really can't hide it anymore. So I see an unmasking or uncovering more so than just increasing.
That's a great way of explaining it. Can you share a couple of incidents from your childhood that you think were formative? They can be positive or difficult, or they can be just memories that for some reason you happen to have in the forefront of your mind.
Of course. I think psychiatry is the only medical field that I've ever worked in where our direct individual stories have the ability to translate over to positive patient care. Because the things in psychiatry that we work with is we deal with the art of people. We deal in the art of storytelling. We deal in the art of people's histories. And I was lucky enough to come from a multi-diverse background. I mentioned that I was raised in a Sicilian American neighborhood. I jumped over to an all-Black high school in St. Louis, Missouri, then completed over 10 years of stay in Alabama, which is about as south as you can get in the U.S., and then finally here in the Midwest in Chicago. So I was lucky to be exposed to so many different people, so many different backgrounds, have so many different kinds of friends and mentors along the way. And it really informed my decision that what I enjoyed most is working with people. Additionally, I'd say the thing that makes us all uniquely human is the experience of suffering. And meaning can't be derived without some suffering. And in my opinion, the antithesis to suffering is the feeling of relief. I am very lucky to be in this field where I can take some of the lessons not only I've learned personally, but the lessons that I've learned from my patients as well and pay it forward to other patients.
Right. I'm really interested in a specific incident that you remember from your childhood that comes to mind.
Yeah, I would say when I was much younger, things like financial stability was a rarity in my experience. Here in the U.S., coming from blue-collared family members, money has always been an issue. And I never really understood why everyone was so focused on that. I remember parents losing their jobs. My father, unfortunately, had a really big work-related physical accident. He went on short-term disability for a while and was not able to work. And I remember just experiencing so much confusion as a young teenager, where money, which was the source of all our problems, kind of snowballed into other issues where now with money issues came stress, came anxiety, came depression, came irritability, came anger. And that in a small household where I was an only child was quite difficult to manage. And I remember at the time just thinking, wow, is this all life would be? Because at the time, that was my only lived experience. I had nothing else to anchor against. And luckily, I had enough folks in my high school and mentors along the way that gave me glimmers of hope where, hey, you know, life can be perhaps something more than your current lived experience. And I owe it to many of those teachers and mentors for helping me get out of that environment and allowing me to move forward to become who I am today.
Mm-hmm. But the memories and the anxiety would still reside in your nervous system, and you would still have to find ways to discharge that so it didn't color the way you see your patients, right? How did you deal with that?
We know things like anxiety that definitely embeds, even now as an adult, it's a double-edged sword. You know, on one end, it serves as a great pool of a sense of urgency. So whenever a giant task is placed in front of me, I do sense that sense of urgency, and it helps drive me to get things done. But to your point, it's very important as a clinician to be mindful of what we call our countertransferential response when we're speaking with patients.
Right.
And for the audience, countertransference in a gist is coming from the clinician's perspective, what is the feeling being activated, likely through previous lived experiences or intrinsic biases? What are those things that are being activated in the room that probably don't have a place in the room, but there's something about that interaction that reminds us as clinicians of something in our past?
Particularly if you're an empathetic person, which I suspect you are.
Yeah. You know, I think empathy is an interesting tool in our work. It is a great way to start a conversation. It is a great way to build rapport. But I also find that empathy can be short-sighted. And what I mean by that is, if we only utilize empathy as a clinician, we're not utilizing the entirety of the tools we have. So I see empathy as a great way to start the conversation. But then it's up to us as clinicians to utilize those other tools to help our patients solve or manage their realities.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do when you notice that there's some countertransference happening with you? And how are you able to move past that and refocus on the patient?
I think earlier on in my career, I was taught that countertransference was, quote, a not positive thing to have in the room. I've now grown to understand that it can be quite helpful as a clinician. For myself and my team, what I teach is not ignoring that feeling, but asking ourselves, why might that be present? And What I do is I have a method, which I describe as I have 1 foot in the door, meaning I'm there with the patient. I'm listening. I'm engaged. But I also have 1 foot out the door. And the foot out the door allows me the perspective to see myself as a participant in the encounter. And notice that if there is a countertransferential response trying to be brewed or summoned, I ensure that I don't actually respond in that manner. Because oftentimes, if I were to do that, it is the exact response the patients have felt for the entirety of their lives. And in order to build a healthy clinical therapeutic relationship, one of my roles as a clinician is to show them that a different relationship dynamic can exist. I oftentimes catch myself, use it diagnostically to take a step back and ensure that I am not responding in that automatic way.
Right. It's noticing it and being aware of it, but then putting it aside, saying, I see it, I notice it, it may not be relevant to this patient at this time. Mm. Or it may even be counterproductive, as what you mentioned earlier. Did I get that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, so that was one memory that came up for you. Is there something that came up from your adolescence or young adulthood that you think might have been formational for you in terms of culture and leadership?
Yeah. I mentioned my grandparents immigrating to open a fish market, you know, back in the 70s in New York. The one thing that was quite formative for me was seeing how much my grandparents invested their time, energy, and attention to their employees. And because they were in a customer service sort of market where they were selling fish and seafood, you would think that they would focus on the customers first. But in fact, I noticed that when they treated their employees in such a magnificent way, those dividends paid off in the interactions with customers automatically.
Totally.
And I've taken those lessons now and apply it to our practice at Mugen Psychiatry, where I attempt to overtly invest not only in the present, but in the futures of my clinicians and my team, because I believe that clinicians that are happy will do better work.
Of course.
And the patients are served as a secondary order effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, your employees are really your first clients. And if you ignore them, then you miss a lot of things that your clients will be bringing to you. So I love the way you approach that. Can you tell me a little bit about what your grandparents did that was different than what other people in a market might do? How did they show support and acknowledgement of their employees? What did they do?
They were always finding ways and reasons to celebrate even the smallest wins their employees would embark on, whether it was professionally or personally. And it was never a sort of calculated move. It always seemed to come from a place of genuine care for the person. So whether it was, a new baby was born, the family expanded, someone was able to buy a house, someone was able to send their child off to college. I just remember my grandparents really celebrating every single win that you would have expected an individual family to experience. But to have that bleed over into the workplace really created an extremely familial culture. And everyone in that room and everyone in the fish market always knew that they could speak to my grandparents for any kinds of problems going on and that they would have support immediately. That's one of the beautiful things about having a smaller business, I think, which is one is able to better control for those types of relationships as the owners are not stretched thin managing hundreds of thousands of employees, et cetera. And it really informed my decision to keep the current practice at a manageable size so that we can have that sort of interaction for all of our clinicians and employees.
Right. Were both your grandparents Korean?
Yeah.
So where does the Chinese come in?
Yeah. So the Chinese side is on my dad's side.
On your dad's side, I see.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know if that is a cultural trait so much. I have a Korean daughter-in-law, and I have read a lot of post-colonialist literature written by Korean, Chinese, and Japanese authors or heritage authors to see if I can understand some nuances of my daughter-in-law's personality better, along with, of course, direct experience and lots of conversations with her. But it seems to me that the criticism is much more common as a way to help people perfect their character than to compliment and support. So what you're saying to me is that your grandparents didn't do that. They were supportive and celebrating even the smallest win and helpful and open to listening to problems. It sounds like they were not judging people who would come to them with something that's an issue. They would have listened carefully and thought what might be helpful.
That's absolutely the case. And I really credit that to the family dynamic. So a little bit of background, my grandfather on that side, obviously, you know, came from Korea. His mother married a man from the US. You know, she was sort of remarried and together they came to America. And I wonder if some of the American culture integrated in with some of those more traditional Korean values to lead to this sort of hybrid thing. You know, there were definitely things that were distinctly culturally Korean. For example, we always celebrated things with a lot of Korean food. Family meal times or employee meal times were very important where everyone sat down at the same table. These sort of things translated quite well. But I do wonder if that hybrid of the family led to sort of this mixed level of support.
Well, it creates a third experience that's created from bringing them together and applying them to your own context. So people talk about the third culture being created through those hybrid experiences. And that's probably what happened at that level. I mean, it's hard to tell. We're just speculating on it now. But It sounds like it was positive. And it brings me to my next question, which is, because we all grew up in multiple different cultural contexts, so from the cultures that you were born into, what would you say your conscious influences you now?
Wow. It's hard to pinpoint a singular thing, but I will say that the lens in which I use to view the world, to view relationships, to view individuals and everything in between has really been affected by my clinical training and the conversations I have with patients.
Mm-hmm. That would come later. Those are the cultures you chose to belong to, but the ones that you were born into. We're often not conscious of them until we get older and we start reflecting on them.
Mm.
I mean, you mentioned Korean food, but there would have been other things too that would have affected your sense of who you are and where, how you belong in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Distinctly, one of my first mentors ever in life was my childhood Taekwondo teacher. And I remember being 8 years old, moderately overweight, completely failing at every other ball sport known to man, as my mother would say. So we tried out Taekwondo. And I just remember my teacher at the time spending so much extra time and care with me to help me build some discipline. And I remember a lesson he shared with me was, he said, "Alan, the world doesn't get any easier. You just tend to get better if you choose to."
That's lovely.
Being 8 years old, I didn't quite understand what that meant, right, as one can imagine, and the depths of what that really meant until now. I am much older and I hearken back to that memory and I say, wow, that's probably one of the most important lessons I was ever shared.
True. Mm. That's a great way to move forward. So how about when you went into your professional life, and the discipline of psychiatry must have, like, as you mentioned, very much informed who you are and how you see yourself. What stands out for you?
I learned the importance of operatively defining words and not accepting general terms or general rules or general expectations as the end all be all. An example I can share is, what does it mean to be happy? This is a topic that comes up clinically in practice quite often. And I found that there are some universal truths I've noticed in my clinical practice and also in my own life, one of which being, if happiness were to be defined as asking for something outside of ourselves, it's sort of a losing battle. Because one cannot have any sort of sense of or control over what one receives. So then that led me to say, well, how do I define happiness now operatively? I define it now as, how can I be useful to others? And I further define it as, what can I do or give? And if I redefine happiness as that, all of a sudden, I have much more of a say of what I can give rather than what I can receive.
Well, it's an orientation towards service and altruism. Being there in service of others gives a sense of purpose and nobility and dignity that if you just focus on what can I get is the opposite. It just diminishes who you are.
It also goes back to what is within our internal locus of control.
Exactly.
you know, at the end of the day, I cannot expect anything from the universe, no matter how hard I ask for it, no matter how hard I shout into the void. But I do have some say in what I might be able to give.
Yeah, I like that very much. And that does give you a sense of locus of control, which is so necessary for people not to fall into things like depression and hopelessness, don't you think?
Absolutely. I see a lot of suffering occurring because there's an inability to clearly choose a path. And there's sort of two paths for many problems. The first path is it a problem to be solved? And then the second path is, or is it a reality to be managed?
Mm-hmm.
And even if you were to understand, hey, this is a reality to be managed, you can then ask the question of, but is there anything else I could possibly do here?
Right. I like it. That's a good way to look at things. So I'm thinking about the culture of Taekwondo. You must have taken some things from that. You must have taken some things from just being an academic, being a clinician. What are some other things? You know, I really think we're standing on the shoulders of giants.
Mm-hmm.
We get one little idea and it's based on thousands of ideas from other people. Otherwise, we wouldn't even have the one that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's giving honor and homage to the groups that shaped us, to reflect on how they have formed us and to be grateful for those moments that taught us something. So I'm wondering, as you're growing up and into your professional culture, what other things stand out for you as being what you're grateful for that you were able to adopt into who you are?
One of the things I concluded pretty recently, actually, to be honest, was changing the definition of success and what should be celebrated, even on a personal level. Going back to Taekwondo, I remember being 8 years old, moderately overweight, not knowing what I was doing. And then my teacher at the time trained me to become the youngest first degree black belt in the school's history.
Hmm.
Now, at face value, one might think, hey, that's great. Well, that should be celebrated. But when I look back, that was an awful lot of work. And I never was there just for an hour a day. He always kept me longer. And only recently, after finishing my medical school degree and finishing training, rather than a black belt, now it's sort of the title of physician and medical doctor, et cetera. And again, one of those things that one might celebrate at face value. But I've come to this conclusion where we like to celebrate the outcome, but we should be celebrating the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people may even change their minds if they understood what the journey was and the context and the sacrifices it might have taken, because all we ever see is an end result.
So what if your journey has been painful and abusive? You don't really want to celebrate that typically.
True. And this is a topic I discuss a lot with my patients, but it's sort of, how do you build that internal thermometer where you can understand hot and cold? And what I mean by that is, when one is suffering or going through a traumatic experience, for example, the only thing that person wants is relief. And what we admire as a society typically has to deal with things like strong character. But character isn't built by an easy life. We don't admire folks who actually have an easy life necessarily. We might admire the things they have. But I take that as, in order to find relief, one must understand the context of their suffering. Now, in order to move on from the suffering, well, that requires a lot more. And oftentimes, I lean in the camp of trying to assign meaning to the suffering,
mm-hmm.
so that context can be created. And if we are the stories we tell ourselves, how do we make that story make sense?
Yeah. What have you learned as a result of this painful experience? What character traits and virtues has it built that you may not have otherwise? What hot and cold nuances are you able to perceive that others may miss?
Mm. I actually have a great concrete example for the listeners.
You sure. Know, that'd be great.
I worked with a client of mine, and this client had gone through a plethora of trauma that it would be hard to even understand the level of trauma that someone can experience at such a young age. And they came to me and they said, I don't believe life is worth living. I cannot see myself moving through life because of the things that have happened in the past, which were objectively quite difficult. So I said to the client, hypothetically speaking, if you were to move forward, what might you pursue or want to do? And the client told me, perhaps I might study psychology. Perhaps I might be a therapist. Well, I said, very interesting. And if you were a therapist, humor me, who might you work with? Well, I'd probably work with clients like myself. And I said to them, don't you think you might be able to provide a level of depth, a level of empathy, a level of understanding for those clients just like you that perhaps no one else in the world could provide? You couldn't imagine how important your presence might be for others. And have you considered that if you did go that path, all of your experiences leading up until then, including those horrendous ones, may actually still have purpose? They opened their eyes quite wide and said, I didn't think of it like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of goes back to that theory of happiness again, where once we assign meaning to suffering, how do we then utilize that meaning altruistically in a way in which we can give rather than receive?
Right.
And that's how those two concepts sort of tie in.
Yes. Nice example. And that creating possibility, you opened up the horizon of possibility for that client. What if this happened? And if that happened, who could you serve? And how would your experience benefit them? It's the what if questions that when you're feeling hopeless, you can't think of those questions.
Mm.
That was so helpful for the client to hear that from you. We don't have control over the outcome, but even that moment of hope could be quite necessary.
It goes back to the two primary drivers in life are this pull into an idealistic future or a push away from pain, typically in our past. And I found for a lot of clients, they're unable to look towards the future due to hopelessness. And for those clients, if I am personally unable to create that window of hope for them to see, I'll actually rely on that second motivator, which is the push away from pain. Now, one might not know where they're going in the future, but most of the time, we know where we don't want to be. And those lead into very interesting conversations as well.
Mm-hmm. So how would you say your temperament and personality affect the way you see the world? Temperament being what you're born with plus social influences, and then personality being what you add on as you go through life and overcome or not overcome obstacles. What's your temperament? Would you say people have said, oh yeah, Alan's like that ever since he was little. And then what have you added on personality-wise?
It's a very interesting question because I think, first of all, no one in the family would have ever thought I would be a psychiatrist. I can tell you that. Or if my young childhood friends, I was quite a nihilist and an introverted one at that for much of my life, especially in childhood. Quite quiet, reserved, quite introverted, a bit anxious around others, always preferring to sit alone rather than interact with others.
Thoughtful, observant.
Mm.
Reflective.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And what did you add on?
Well, I noticed that those sides to me were not solving any problems that I was experiencing. And I got to learn, again, through very important mentors, the benefits of stepping out of one's comfort zone. And now folks might describe me more as a extroverted appearing introvert. But that extroverted appearingness really was something I've learned over the years because I learn more through conversations with others than I can ever learn alone. And it took me a lot to train myself to be able to do that.
Mm. Well, maybe you developed the quality of being a social introvert.
That sounds spot on.
Mm. So can you recall a time when you felt that your understanding of the world suddenly was thrown into juxtaposition in front of you and you went, wait, I thought that was what everybody did and it isn't. When you had a moment of cultural dissonance.
Mm.
It can be something very small, like somebody mentioned to me how in some places it's the norm to give people a glass of water while they're waiting for their meal in a restaurant, and in other places it's not. Or it can be something a little bit more significant, that a social norm that just you suddenly realize that there's social class. I didn't notice that before. It can be all sorts of different things. It can be a language experience too. So anything that threw you into a sense of cultural dissonance where you started to recognize these differences between what you thought was normal and what was just your experience.
Mm. I had to relearn coming up with the reasons why things were or were not happening. I think socially, I was always taught there might be a reason why you're not able to get a certain outcome that you're striving towards. You know, perhaps for myself, hey, Alan, you can't go to this nice college because no one in your family has ever gone to college. At face value, maybe there's some truth in that, but I had to relearn that there was a yes and nature when answering those kinds of questions. Why can't I go to this nice Ivy League college? Well, Alan's because no, you don't know anyone from Ivy League schools. Yes, but there needs to be an and. And I think one of the things I learned was when I didn't add on that and part, it allowed me to sort of close the loop in my mind as to why or why not the world was fair or unfair. But once I added on the and, I was able to tack on some more explanations to the problem that I had a direct hand in participating in. Okay, well, Alan, you didn't get into a nice Ivy League school, and that's because your family has never gone to school. Yes, and do I even know what it means to be in an Ivy League school? Is that even what I want?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think looking back, I'm happy everything worked out the way it did, but it brings a new level of perspective when you can tack on the and in otherwise situations where you might just take a singular explanation as a universal truth.
Totally. What about from a more immediate experience? Like, for example, when you went to the University of Alabama, that must have been a little bit of a shock to the system if you're not used to the culture of the South, if you're not used to Black culture. Any memories there that stand out for you?
Yeah, I think being able to maintain my core self, but also be open to the cultures that I was now a part of was a very interesting learned experience. You know, coming from Brooklyn, New York, I once upon a time had the quintessential New York accent, which completely went away when I moved to the South. And now I say it canceled out with all the Southern accents that exist in Alabama. But I remember jumping into school in Alabama and our AP literature teacher was reading Huck Finn. And she already had a deep Southern accent. And I remember being in the classroom thinking I was hearing a different language completely. I looked around the room and I asked my newfound peers, what is she saying? What are we reading? I was horrified. And I remember coming home from school that day telling my parents, I absolutely cannot do this, guys. I don't know what's going on here. My first experience in Alabama definitely was biased. And of course, I was intrinsically wanting to perhaps go back to a bigger city already. And I was just utilizing confirmation bias as finding reasons why I would not fit in here, trying to justify some of the challenges I was having as a high school teenager. And then I had this realization that, well, Alan, you'll always be in a new environment at some point, whether it's high school or college or your first job or your second or fifth or a relationship or a friendship. What was exactly my expectation that every transition, quote, should be smooth? I remember asking myself that and it's like, well, duh. Well, sure, of course it's not going to be smooth, man.
Yeah. You know, your story reminded me of an experience that I had a number of years ago. The first time I went to the South, I'm Canadian, I went to the South, and people would always ask me in the Southern accent, where are you from, girl? And I know that's not the right accent, but I go, Canada. And they go, you from Canada? Right. And nobody had any problem understanding my accent when I was in the South. in the two southern states where I was. Nobody ever complained that they couldn't understand me or anything. But when I was in Washington a couple of years later, people were always saying, what are you saying? Come again? I don't get your accent. And they sounded really similar to me. And they couldn't understand what I was saying, even though our accents were fairly similar. And I just thought that was so funny. And it just hit me at the time that, gee, when I was in the South, nobody had any trouble understanding me at all. I wonder how that happened. So it wasn't certainly when people started going on about something, I didn't understand what they were saying either. But it just seemed to me that that was a really strange disconnect that hit me when I was in Washington.
Well, you know, I think between the Southerners and folks from Washington, if we had to label one of the two as more polite, I think the South would win in that regard all the time.
Oh, yeah. Southern politeness and hospitality.
Absolutely.
For sure. Yes. So we're just about at the end of the interview, and I'm just wondering, what brings out the best in you? What kind of environment allows you to most comfortably flourish? If you're in a work environment, what brings out the best in you?
It's a fine balance of being able to lean in to things that recharge me. And I think I'm still learning this, and it'll be an ever-long study, but determining what are the activities and behaviors that recharge me versus drain me. And then how do I double down on that?
Mm-hmm.
And understanding that those activities and behaviors may not be what other people utilize, and that's okay. And it's all right to redefine exactly what it is on an individual level. What does that for me? And as it stands, it's definitely a mix of being able to educate, being able to provide clinical care directly, and still enjoying that high school Alan preference of sitting alone for a couple hours a day to do deep work. Those things are serving me quite well so far.
Mm, nice. Mm. Here's your soapbox moment. What would you like to promote?
You know, in general, my challenge to the audience would be, going off the tail end of what I just said, learn to define things operatively on an individual level and allow yourself permission to double down on that which works for you. Otherwise, I do have a weekly newsletter called Thought for the Week, and I'm quite active on LinkedIn.
Wonderful. I'll make sure that's in the show notes. So is there anything else that you'd like to say?
The answer would always be yes.
Words of wisdom or closing comments?
Really, as a recap, learn to redefine happiness as perhaps what can you do or give? How does one become useful? And double down on what works for you, whether it's the people you surround yourself with, the work you engage in, the hobbies you engage in.
Very nice. It's been such a pleasure to hear your answers to these questions and to get to know you a little bit better through the interview. Thank you so very much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks to the audience.
Dr. Akira was a reflective only child born in the U.S. to Korean and Chinese parents, with memories of his grandparents working in their fish market. It was in that context that he first experienced the power of showing care and support to your employees. His grandparents celebrated every small win at work and supported the efforts of their employees, so they earned deep loyalty and respect from the staff. Later, he was mentored by a particularly helpful Taekwondo instructor who helped him develop the discipline he has since used throughout his life. Now, as an accomplished psychiatrist with employees of his own, Dr. Akira embraces internally the same model he helps his clients cultivate. True happiness comes from seeing what you can give and being of service to others. From my interview with Dr. Alan Akira, here are a few gems of wisdom that stand out in my mind. One, suffering becomes a way to serve as you go beyond it to find the purpose through that suffering. Two, developing the character traits you need to solve your own problems requires regularly stepping out of your comfort zone to practice them. 3. As an introvert, Dr. Akira is mindful of the ways his energy is depleted during the day and spends time in silent thought each day to balance himself. 4. One may feel empathy towards another person, but if empathy reinforces the only life experience they know, empathy may not be serving them. Considering what if can open up possibilities and start a new hopeful train of thought. I loved my interview with Dr. Alan Akira, and if you did too, consider subscribing to his newsletter called Thought of the Week, which you can find on his LinkedIn profile. Listeners, I encourage you to follow the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast on your iPhone podcast app, or subscribe if you have an Android device. If you have an Android device and you press subscribe, or on your iPhone you press follow, it means you will be notified of weekly episodes and you can easily share them with a friend. Thank you for listening. And may Culture and Leadership Connections continue to guide and inspire your day. Newsflash. Listeners can now interact with Culture and Leadership Connections podcast by leaving a voice or text message on FanList. It is a fun and quick way to let me know what you liked, ask a question, or leave a suggestion. I will feature some of the voice messages on upcoming episodes. You might be surprised to hear your own voice, but only if you leave a message, of course. So to leave your personal message or your question, go to shiftworkplace.com/podcast and click on the FanList link to leave it. I can hardly wait to hear what you have to say.